Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me. Of all the topics I've covered on this long journey through prehistory, the Austronesians and the Neolithic migrations into island Southeast Asia and Oceania might be the one I find the most compelling. Relative to their importance in shaping the subsequent millennia of history, I mean, hundreds of millions of people speak an Austronesian language today, these migrations and developments have received very little attention. But thanks to a huge variety of different kinds of evidence, ranging from pottery to ancient DNA to the Austronesian languages themselves, we can understand what happened in island Southeast Asia and Oceania 4,000 years ago in striking detail. Thanks to this variety of evidence, more of which is being uncovered all the time, our understanding of these past processes is changing rapidly. Today's guest works right on the cutting edge of all these topics. Mike Carson is an associate professor of archaeology at the University of Guam, and he is one of the world's leading experts on the archaeology of Oceania, Austronesian migrations, the prehistory of the Mariana Islands, and the study of archaeological landscapes. He's the author, most recently, of Archaeology of Pacific Oceania, Inhabiting a Sea of Islands, and has collaborated on a truly staggering number of scholarly articles on everything from pottery and radiocarbon dating to ancient DNA and lost landscapes. Professor Carson, thank you so much for joining me.
Patrick, thank you for inviting me on the program. I'm so happy to be part of your podcast.
Well, thank you. So let's start with the most basic thing here. What got you interested in archaeology and more specifically in the archaeology of island Southeast Asia and Oceania?
For me, I came into archaeology as one of many interests growing up. You know, I loved watching documentary films and reading books in libraries and exploring in nature. And archaeology I viewed as part of, you know, that larger learning about how the world works and how things came to be the way they are today. And I didn't think archaeology even was a legitimate profession that someone could do. I thought, well, the people I see on television or what I read in books, they are just these eccentric people or independently wealthy. There is not really something I could do. Only after making films about archaeology and natural history did I learn you could learn about these things, and real jobs are available, working in government offices, working for private companies like in roadwork construction. They always need archaeologists and so on. You could be the person performing the archaeology work, not just the person behind the camera making a documentary film, like those famous archaeologists that I knew at the time, Dr. Indiana Jones, who was doing all the things that I love to do. Like, he was not just someone who studied artifacts in a museum or reading books in a library, but he brought that knowledge as well as his ability to explore the natural world and survive in the environment and knowing about traditional cultures, history, and language, bringing all of that together to solve problems, overcome challenges, and solve mysteries in archaeology. And of course, the adults around me told me that Indiana Jones is a fictional character. This is a fantasy adventure story, and it doesn't really work that way. But I thought it was possible, and indeed, many aspects of the fictional stories of Indiana Jones and others really are based on some core of reality about the adventure of scientific learning and discovery and solving problems. Those aspects are accurate, but of course, some things are fantastical. And then I felt that I want to be the person leading my own excavations and explorations. I want to be the person writing books about archaeology and changing the way we think about the world. So that meant, yes, I need to continue on with a doctorate degree. You need to have a question, you know, that you're addressing, something new and original that changes our thoughts about archaeology. That needs to be your thesis. And I learned about the Pacific Islands region as a place where people were doing some new and interesting work. And moreover, at the time when I was thinking about graduate school, migrations were a very important cultural issue in the modern day. And I thought, this must have been true in the past, of course, and in the Pacific Islands, how did people even, you know, reach those islands to live there in the first place? So all that came together for me developing what I wanted to do as my PhD studies in archaeology, and that brought me into the Pacific region. So I started from that perspective in Hawaii, learning about Hawaiian and Polynesian archaeology, and then gradually learning that, well, in fact, the farther west you go in the Pacific, the older those sites are, the older the traditions and the language, and even the landscapes are much older. And then you get farther to the west into Southeast Asia or even East Asia, you get much, much older, even like into Homo erectus and ancient hominins time. So it gets more and more complicated and older. And then I realized, well, I've been looking at everything backwards. I need to start the story at the beginning and work in chronological order. And that meant reaching out to colleagues who really are the experts in East Asia, in mainland and island Southeast Asia, but they don't know too much about the Pacific. And then us meeting together and collaborating, talking about what joins us together, which is not necessarily archaeology, but rather the larger picture of Austronesian languages that cross over that area. And everything started coming together for me in my research, thinking, now I understand how this happened in chronological order, about people migrating from one region to another, and then separating into different islands, developing different language and culture and history, and I can trace the parallels in the archaeology.
I want to touch on a couple of the things that you mentioned there. I mean, the first is one of the things that's really striking in looking at Pacific archaeology with kind of a broader worldview in mind is that it's very interdisciplinary. People are working in a lot of different related subfields. You mentioned linguistics is one of them, that all of this comes together to a pretty coherent way of looking at the past. And the second one is, I mean, obviously you mentioned the salience of migration, which is an issue that for so long was neglected in other parts of the world and fell out of fashion for decades as an explanation for historical change, but you can't think about the Pacific and the islands in the Pacific without having migration first and foremost in your mind. That has to be there because otherwise people can't get from place to place. So it's interesting looking at the Pacific and seeing the methodological sophistication and the interdisciplinary nature of it and the emphasis on migration as kind of being ahead of the curve in reflecting trends in archaeology elsewhere.
You hit on a really good point that working in the Pacific Islands is more of this ideal situation where you can address these issues, not only in archaeology, but also in language studies, in DNA studies, not only with modern populations and, you know, mutations and, you know, inferring what happened in the past, but also with ancient DNA directly from archaeological context of real, like directly measured ancient dates, and then knowing what the DNA of the population was like during these different time periods. So we now have all of these ways of learning about the past. You know, we see bits of broken pottery and stone tools and things like that, or maybe we see what their houses looked like or what kind of rock art they made in ritual caves. Those are really fascinating and interesting things. But that's not the same as what a DNA study can tell you about an entire population of living people. Bringing that together has been very effective in the Pacific region. And you mentioned how migration, you know, movements of people was for a long time considered not really a valid explanation of historical change. Like it describes, yes, people moved from this region to this other region at 1,000 years ago or at 5,000 years ago and interacted with another group. And that's kind of the end of the description part of the story. Now, the explanation part would involve hypothesizing about things like what made them move from one place to another and what was the circumstance of those populations meeting? Were they hostile towards each other? Were they friendly? What was the result? And that is where many, many different hypotheses have been proposed over the last many, many decades, mostly about how farmers move from one place to another. They are sort of fixed in their land space and to a certain degree, honestly, dependent on that land. And having access to that plot of land every year, year after year, in order for their families and their societies to just to survive. And what happens if you encounter a famine or a drought or a warfare or other things? Then you need to move and find more land. Or what happens after a few generations? After a while, the youngest people have no, very little or maybe no access to the land and the resources that they want to have or that they need to have, then they need to go out looking for other places. So where do they go under those circumstances? Well, they go to what's available, first of all, and second of all, exploring to find new places where they could live. And many parts of the world, that process involves finding places where people already are living, but they may not be using that land or the resource to its like 100% full capacity, as was the case in people's homeland, right? So presumably people are leaving their homeland because resources are limited, so they want to find a place where there's better options, right? Just like today. So in the distant past, we could apply that logic toward people looking for the resources that they needed. And what I mean by that is looking not just for places to go farming, but places where people could acquire fish and shellfish, or where they could access rivers or the ocean for communications and trade. All of those things are important for survival of individual people and for the groups of people and the next generations. Now, those are not the only reasons. People migrate for many reasons, but this idea of farmers looking for new land does work in many cases in the past. Not everyone, but in many.
It's one of the things I think is really interesting in looking at your work and the way that you emphasize landscapes is landscapes provide the key that unlocks this, right? Because in the work that you did in looking at where people were living in Taiwan just around 4,000 years ago, and then where they were living when they migrated to the northernmost Philippine island of Luzon, they were looking for the same kinds of places. They wanted sites where they had access to fresh water and salt water. They wanted places where they were raised up above the landscape. They wanted places where they could maybe do a little bit of farming if they wanted to, but they weren't dependent on it. And it's so striking that like this seems to be the key that unlocks the migration is they're thinking, okay, well, we want to live someplace that's like the place that we left, but that has more available land for us. And when you apply that logic, you can see precisely the right spots.
Yeah, you described that very well. Like in archaeology, for a long time, people have developed what we call geoarchaeology or environmental archaeology. I've followed in that tradition what we now call like landscape archaeology, looking at where people lived in the terrain and the habitats around them. And we can do that very well in geology, seeing the geological landforms, sedimentary units, but we also can add into that picture where the water sources were, the fresh water sources, as well as the ocean and swampy environments, different kinds of forest composition where people could gather birds, fruit bats, and different kinds of foods available, as well as the shellfish and fishing resources. All of that comes into understanding what a landscape was like and how people interacted with that. Of course, we all know that landscapes change through time, especially with change in climate, change in sea level, change in the relationship between the land and the sea. Different species evolve depending on what's happening around them, and the influence of people on the environment. Now, wherever people have lived, they create some kind of impact. The only question is, to what degree was that impact? Was it minimal, or was it severe, or was it somewhere in between? You know, what was the impact, and how did that affect the next stages? Like, for example, if the impact was quite severe right from the beginning, then that could instigate a greater or more urgent need for the next generations to look for other places to live. Or that impact was beneficial because it was creating the kind of environment that people wanted to have, right? Now, you asked about how the landscape approach tells us about what that environment or habitat looked like. And yeah, it really does. It gives us an idea of what was available in an area. So for example, when I work in the Mariana Islands, when I look at the islands, I see first of all, beautiful landscapes all around me everywhere I look. But secondly, I see how they develop through time. I could look and see, okay, I know that place over there 3,000 years ago was underneath the ocean. So I will not find, you know, a 3,000-year-old site there. I need to look in another location that was above water at that time. So I'm going to look there and see if I can find an ancient site. And oftentimes you do, sometimes you don't. And whether it's a positive or negative finding, the result tells me something about where people were choosing to live. And the places where people lived always are in places where they could access fresh water, which could be different than what you see today, thanks to change in sea level. Places where they could access the ocean for that very reliable source of protein in primarily shellfish, but also other fishes and turtles and other marine animals, and places where they could access within reasonable distance into the stable, uplifted landforms that are above the danger zone of typhoons and storm surges, where they could know reasonably well that year after year they could access land for growing taro, for growing yams, or for just collecting the natural fruits and nuts from the trees that already live there, as well as others that they could plant on their own. So those are the kinds of places that we see, and they have changed through time, in some cases quite dramatically. So my work involves sort of stripping back those layers of time and then starting from the beginning and saying, okay, I want to start with these 4,000 years old sites, or 3,000 years in some places, or 2,000 in other places. Start with the oldest and then work my way forward to understand what happened there.
Well, so that's really fascinating because it gives you a much greater chance of finding the kinds of sites that you want to look for, right? Instead of relying on kind of random chance, or like say in Europe after the Second World War, when they were doing, you know, massive scale excavations and they just found a bunch of these sites belonging to, say, the linear pottery culture. They just happened to strip off a whole bunch of these areas of loose soil that happened to be where these people really liked to live. And so now we happen to know a lot about this particular culture because they happen to do that kind of randomly and find those sites. But you can go very intentionally and say, okay, I know the landscape. I can be pretty sure the landscape looked like this at this particular time. I know these people liked sites like this. I can go here and I can try to find these kinds of sites. That's a much more directed way of going about finding the kind of archaeology that you're looking for.
Yes, it is. And I have been very fortunate that I've been able to do that working where I work. And part of the effectiveness has been that I live where I work. I see my friends and neighbors at the supermarket or at Kmart or places on a daily basis, and they ask me questions about archaeology, and I ask them questions about, well, what's interesting to you? I mean, what would you like to learn about the ancient past or the more recent past? And then we develop more of a partnership of questions that are interesting and how I can communicate those results in a way that people find interesting or useful for them, instead of me writing a report that goes into a government office and nobody else ever reads it. I want to produce results that people enjoy. Like thinking back to what made me interested in archaeology, like, you know, going to museums, reading books, watching documentary films. I want to do that for other people, you know, make the information useful for them. So that's not always about writing a book. It's also about presenting public lectures, speaking with you in a podcast, even talking with news reporters, sharing things on YouTube and Twitter, you know, making sure people have access to the information they want to know. And then that helps me learn what is interesting and how to communicate. And because of that background, I have been able to ask for permission to work in the places where I want to work, and then go after that information. Like I can look at a place in Guam or in Saipan or Tinian, these different islands, saying, that's the place where I want to go work, right? And I say, I want to dig 2 meters beneath the ground to find what I'm interested in learning. And then I try to, you know, work with the community about, is this interesting to you? Is it worthwhile to know? And the answer always is yes, but you need time to get there in a way that is beneficial for everybody, right? Whereas earlier in my career, I was a contracting archaeologist. So I was the person, you know, whenever a road was being built or a hotel being developed, they tell me, well, you need to go here and survey and find the sites and tell us what's here. And in that sense, that was great because I learned so many things about so many places in a short amount of time. But I wasn't going to the place. I wasn't able to say, oh, I want to dig there. It's like, no. You're working here. This is the place. Like what you described in Europe for understanding the linear band ceramic culture and other things of ancient Europe. It was because roads happened to be placed somewhere or airports were built in a certain location. And then you learn about that location. It just happened to be in the place with all of that archaeological information. And so after that experience of seeing how things work, it's kind of a hit or miss situation, right? After accumulating that, then I knew better about, yes, this is the kind of landscape that was here 3,000 years ago. And if I want to learn about that, then I need to go dig there and then working on it from that direction. Otherwise, you end up in a situation of exploring a landscape that you see today and finding many, many things on the surface that relate with the last time people were living there. So those are really interesting. Don't get me wrong about that. That relates to very, very important parts of our cultural history. And usually, like in the Pacific Islands, that would relate to a critical moment of contact with European groups and imperial and colonial events. And so that gives you the last time when the older traditional society was functioning without that layer of influence. So those are really important sites, but they are honestly the most recent. And if you want to learn about the distant past, you need to look at the older layers, sometimes beneath the ground in exactly those sites, but very often, at least in my work, they're not in those locations. They're in completely different landforms and situations at a time when the sea level was different, at a time when the forest was very different, or even the coral reefs were not the same coral reefs that we see now. So the places where people could have lived or where they could have accessed their food resources or their fresh water were very different than what we see on the surface today. I like to look in that perspective of what was it like for people at that ancient time, not what I'm seeing now, but what did they see, and then go from there.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/youknowbusiness.
If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list all of them and how much you're paying? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes. But let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. I can't believe how many I had and all the money I was wasting. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
It's a really interesting perspective because I feel like the landscape approach really helps to explain how Malayo-Polynesian dispersals happened and why they would have happened so rapidly over such long distances is that if you have people who are accustomed to a particular kind of environment and they have the means of traveling, they have the technological package that allows them to travel over long distances, why would you choose to live someplace that isn't ideal for you if you can just hop a little bit further down the coast and find the next spot that's exactly what you want? I mean, just instead instead of trying to live someplace that, you know, it doesn't really have the best access to fresh water, or, you know, there isn't a nice shellfish bed here, or there isn't a reef, you can just say, well, why don't I just go, you know, a half a day's sail further down the coast and find the spot that is exactly right. And when you aggregate that over a couple of centuries, you can easily see how you would have people who have traveled thousands and thousands of miles.
Yes, I would like to emphasize something you mentioned there, which is people looking for other coasts, right? Coastlines are so important in human evolution, you know, what some people call us an edge species, meaning we live at the edge of the land and the sea, whether that's the sea coast or coast of a lake or the coast of a river, have always have been important for us as human species. I mean, we need access to water in order to live. And some people may say, but wait a minute, the ocean is not drinkable water. Ah, but near sea level is where you always can find a coastal seeps of like the natural water table coming out where you can access fresh water, or in the slightly inland areas from the seacoast, you can find springs or caves where the water table is accessible, or you can find stream and river drainages or lakes or wetlands. So looking at that, I would say much of the Austronesian story or the Malayo-Polynesian story has involved people looking for coasts. And in some cases, those coasts happen to be very, very far away, days or even weeks of travel overseas to find a new island that happens to be a place of very intensive coastline. So people found more of what they wanted in an island setting. Say we go back in time 4,000 years ago, the land is getting crowded with people, the ideal places for people to live were becoming more scarce. So the easiest thing is just to move somewhere where you're not creating a conflict with your friends and your siblings and your cousins. Maybe I can find a few other people who want to go with me. You know, you need multiple people involved for the transportation, first of all, people who are knowledgeable about navigation and about the technical, you know, aspects of sailing a boat. And then you need all of the people involved in a viable society. So that means not just the biological, you know, aspect of having enough men and especially women to create a new population, a generation, but also the people with knowledge and skills, people who know about how to grow plants, how to find the geological sources for your stone tools, people who know how to find the clays for making your pottery. You need people who know how to construct houses, people who know how to make the canoes for your daily work, or how to identify the fish and the shellfish that are safe to eat. You need all those people for a viable population, and then to pass on that knowledge and that skill to the next generations of people. And that initial finding of an overseas island is not necessarily the exact moment when the settlement of that island happened. There could be a time lag of that information coming back to a homeland or to a different homeland even. And people could migrate more than once, right? So after people settle in a new place, especially in an island setting, nothing should stop them from communicating with homelands, and nothing would stop other people from coming there later. But there is a difference between that founding migration population versus the later movements of people. So that the founding population would be when you see the first horizon in the archaeological record, like that layer of people first living in a place. And we also now have come to learn that indeed, in almost every situation, people never stopped living in the islands. Right? It's a continuous record of people living there and continual change through time. That's in many cases just gradual change. The languages that they spoke at that first time have changed, but we still can detect some of those original features that make each language different in each of the islands. And now with DNA studies, we're finding things like in the Mariana Islands, this very unique, what they call the E2A haplogroup in the modern population that you don't find anywhere else in the remote Pacific Islands. You find it only in the Mariana Islands and in parts of island Southeast Asia, wherever people have collected modern DNA samples. So of course there's a connection. And now through archaeology, finding ancient DNA. It's so far about 2,000 to 2,500 years old, so it's not the oldest, but it's getting there, finding that unique haplotype of the Chamorro people in the Mariana Islands really did exist all the way back then. So there's this continuity of the population. People never were replaced. They weren't killed or wiped out or overtaken by a new group coming in, but rather through time, the population simply became more diverse with more contacts overseas. So like, for example, that earliest population speaking, you know, the unique language and having the unique DNA that we recognize today as uniquely Chamorro background in the Marianas, that existed from the beginning, and then it never went away. But rather, at different points in time, contacts with people from overseas coming in to live there or through other ways created more diversity in the population. So then we see not only that unique E2A haplogroup in the DNA, but also something else called the B4 haplogroup, as well as others. And also in the language, we can detect times when things changed in the Chamorro language, in the Marianas, when people started saying things differently or pronouncing words differently or using alternative forms of grammar that are definitely overlays or borrowings, yet still retained that older feature of the language that makes it ancient Malayo-Polynesian origin. So it never went away. You know, it's still there and continuing through time, yet things become more complex. You can say, aha, at this time, 1,000 years ago, was a massive movement of people throughout the Pacific, many, many places being inhabited. So at that time was when we have the maximum opportunity for cross-contacts and change in language, change in DNA populations, change in the way people make their houses, exchange of ideas about religion and about the kinds of plants that they can grow and eat. And indeed, that time, like 1,000 years ago, like across the Pacific, is a major, major change culturally, linguistically, biologically, and in the archaeological record. But that's very different from what happened thousands of years earlier with initial population movements in some of those regions.
It's really elegant proof of the idea that migration is just a subset of mobility more broadly, and that if you want to understand migration, you have to understand it in the context of all of the other kinds of movement that people do, some of which are permanent, some of which are seasonal. People move for all sorts of reasons, and when people move from one place to another, even a migration is not permanent. Plenty of people will move somewhere for some period of time and then move back. So like every migration has a return stream, right? And when you think about it like that, it not only makes migration a more viable explanation and a more understandable process, it also helps you understand how it's connected to all of those other kinds of movement that define human experiences.
Exactly. So most archaeologists now talk not just about migration, but what we call migration and mobility, right? So that's the catchphrase that we like to use now, is migration and mobility. So looking at not necessarily population migrations, but also, can I identify a kind of stone tool, especially something like obsidian, right, that is transported, you know, from one region of the world to another? And then that's definitive, objective evidence that, yes, people were in contact, because the obsidian itself doesn't just spontaneously move from one place to another. No, a person needed to carry it. So trade was one of the more important motivations behind mobility in a general sense. And that is sort of an overlay over the initial founding, like migrations of population movements. So whenever people moved to a new area, that's essentially expanded the geographic range of what they and their counterparts knew as, like, this is the known world to them at that time. And within that entire region of the known world for them, they could establish trade contacts or other reasons of being in touch with their homeland, because it's their friends, you know, or it's their family and they want to be in contact. Or some people would propose marriage partners at different times, or alliances, you know, in the event of something terrible happening in the environment or socially, that you need to have those alliances overseas just in order to survive. And all of those factors come into mobility, in a sense, being important for survival in a practical sense, as well as just something that people like to do for various reasons. You know, it could be to expand their economic wealth, or it could be just because they like being in contact with people or exploring new places. We know that people migrate for different reasons. You might say at this particular point in time, like say 3,000 years ago, we know that people in this island group were looking for new land, so they went across the ocean to find that new place to live. And that describes mostly what happened, but within that description, some of those individual people probably had other things in mind, and we don't know what they were thinking. We just know the outcome, that they moved from point A to point B, and part of the context for them was that either they or people with them were looking for new land, for places to go farming or places to collect shellfish or whatever it was. But they may have had other things in mind as well.
I want to ask you about one very specific example of that. You live in the Mariana Islands and that you've spent a lot of time working in the Mariana Islands. One of the things that I appreciate about your work in looking at kind of the broad context of why people are moving around into Oceania starting 3,500 years ago or so, is that you've put the Mariana Islands right at the center of that story, which is not someplace that they had previously been. And I'm fascinated, like the Mariana Islands are one of the earliest places that are reached in remote Oceania, despite the fact that you would think like they're way out there. That's a long trip. So how do you think people found the Mariana Islands? And why do you think so early that was a spot that people went to?
Alexander Spohr in the 1950s was like one of the first archaeologists to work in the region and to have radiocarbon dating. It was a new thing, right? And he found that in the Marianas, in certain places that were somehow completely detached from all these monumental sites he found on the surface, completely different areas where he just happened to dig very deep beneath the ground, find this different kind of pottery than he had seen on the surface. It was much older, obviously, because it was deep beneath the ground. It was this beautiful red slip pottery, and he called it Marianas Red. And he found that it was in these old beach sand layers. At the time, 1950s, people didn't know about sea level change the way we do now. But he did know these were ancient beach contexts somehow that are beneath the ground, and he found no wood charcoal that was considered the ideal thing to date, and you wouldn't find it in an ancient beach context at the seashore. So the best he could do was find a layer above it or at the top to date that came out like 1000 BC. So like, this is really old, and the things beneath it obviously are older. So we have people living here at least since 1000 BC. Meanwhile, 1950s also was Gifford and Dick Shuttler excavating the Lapita type site in New Caledonia and radiocarbon dating there as well. That was for the Lapita pottery, which is also a kind of red-slipped pottery, but with a very elaborate and special dentate stamp decoration, finding that specifically dated at about 1000 BC. And the Marianas was older than that. So already in the 1950s, you have this setup of, wow, something is really different and strange in the Marianas at that far northwest corner of the Pacific. And 1960s, 1970s, Alexander Spohr also worked in the Philippines and found what he called Marianas Red pottery in the Philippines and in contexts that also were older than 1000 BC, but he just couldn't quite find the direct dating of it. And then some of his colleagues in Tinian in the Marianas found not only the red slip pottery, but this exquisite dentate stamped pottery, similar to the technique of making dentate stamped pottery of Lapita in the Lapita world. But this is different. It wasn't showing the same motifs of like the face motif of Lapita or the labyrinth that is known in Lapita. What's in the Marianas is something different, but they were finding very small pieces and could not quite figure out what it looked like. So now the picture is looking like the Marianas are very important for understanding the origins of what happened in the Pacific. And then moving forward further into like the 1970s and 1980s, people working in the Philippines, Bill Solheim found again, that dentate stamped pottery in sites of the Philippines, not dated very well, but again, at least 1000 BC. And then flash forward to, say, the 1990s when I was, you know, in graduate school learning about archaeology. Brian Butler, for instance, working in Saipan in the Marianas, said, wow, I found the site that in the Marianas that has all of this decorated dentate stamp pottery. It's beautiful, but the dating is really difficult for me to figure out. And some of his dating was very, very old. Like, it was before 1500 BC. And others were closer to 1500 BC. And then other people in contracting archaeology, working at like golf courses or the military training areas, were finding the same things. And again, it was like, yeah, 1500 BC seems to be the date, but we're just not finding, like, wood charcoal is what everyone wants to date in archaeology for radiocarbon, because it's the most reliable thing that fits with the atmospheric curve of the calibrations in radiocarbon dating. So we want to find wood charcoal, but it just wasn't there. So the dating of the Marianas was difficult to figure out. And people were just perplexed by these situations of digging very, very deep beneath the ground and finding beach sites beneath the ground in places that didn't seem possible. So there must have been some kind of change in sea level or a dramatic change in the geology of the island. This did not make sense. But if you look closely, like I did as a student, some of those Lapita sites in, say, New Caledonia, in Fiji, or one really famous site in Samoa that's offshore and under the ocean, those Lapita sites also were ancient beach sites. You just wouldn't know it today because of the way the landscape has changed. And I thought, that's probably what happened in the Marianas also. So when the time came for me to have the opportunity to work there, I knew about that.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
I was very, very fortunate that geologists like the late Bill Dickinson had been working in Guam and the Marianas, looking at ancient tidal notches of where the sea level used to be and coordinating those tidal notches with coral reefs or ancient fossil coral reefs, and then being able to measure their heights versus the coral reefs that you see today. So saying, in fact, the sea level has changed here about 1.8 meters, and then being able to date it directly because you can obtain dates for corals. So I knew that when I started my work in the region. And I was able to access into places by being part of the community, saying, I really want to dig over there because that's the place I'm going to find the ancient shoreline of when people first lived here. That's probably sometime before 1000 BC, could be 1500 BC, some people say 2000 BC. I want to refine that and find the place where I know I have a good context of an archaeological layer that I can coordinate with this change in the sea level and the landscape. And I did it, you know, so I was very happy. And I was able to dig all the way down to find those old fossil reef layers, directly measure them, directly date them, also find the layers that were the ancient lagoons that had existed in those ancient times more than 3,000 years ago, understand, first of all, what kind of lagoon was it? I also found piles of shellfish that people had discarded. And you can date the shellfish. And then I paired the shellfish remains with what we all love to date, the wood charcoal remains, like inside a piece of pottery from that time. I found, okay, there's this charred bit of charcoal that's still retained in there, didn't get washed away in the ocean, and the shellfish together. I could date both of them, and I know very, very sure about that context. So I did it for cases of like finding inside pottery, finding the paired wood charcoal with the shell inside cooking hearths and rubbish pits, like these situations where I know that really is from that time. It wasn't disturbed. It wasn't involving some older intrusion or old material that happened to be part of the environment. I'm really dating that cultural event and becoming very confident that, yes, indeed, the dates on these materials are accurate through radiocarbon and, as I mentioned, the uranium and the thorium, coral dating, and other ways of cross-referencing and saying, yeah, now I feel really confident I can date these old contexts. Like, for decades, like, as I mentioned, Alexander Spohr was, like, so frustrated he could not find good dating material, but now we can. So I was able to do that at a number of sites. It's not just one site, mind you, in Guam and the Marianas. It's several sites in Guam, in the island of Tinian, and in the island of Saipan all at once. So a large population of people in different places, the dating is replicated at that old age and telling us people were looking not just for any old coastline, but specific places where they found access to their fresh water, either in a coastal sea or in a cave. And inside those caves, I found like these buried layers of like built up the kinds of sediments and siltation that you find in the bottom of a water pool sort of area. So look, and the measurements came out that, yeah, the elevation is about right for the water table to have been there at that time, but not now. So the water source, finding places like a break in the coral reef that existed at that ancient time, that's based on digging enough to find those ancient coral reefs. So the break in the reef is where people would have access into the ocean, or protected lagoon areas where sailing and was easier and where access to the shellfish was easier, and places that had a little bit of elevated landform, not necessarily where people were living, but just nearby, where they could access the stable forest resources. The cave sites that I mentioned were mostly for, you know, special purpose. They, people weren't living in the caves. They were collecting water from the caves or creating very strange rock arts that we don't know what they represent, but some cases are handprints, others are geometric designs we don't understand, or representing human figures in contorted positions. So we may not know exactly what ritual or ceremony happened, but we can respect that it was different. And that was part of people living in the islands from the beginning. So it opened my view that we can't think of people moving to live in distant islands as just like a fight for survival. That part is true, but they also were having a full cultural and meaningful life in many, many ways. So that made me start thinking very differently about how people lived in the past. And that's kind of a new direction for me, was the first I learned the practicalities, and only more recently did I start exploring these kind of ritual areas. And honestly, it's much more productive in that way. If I had dug in the caves first, then I would have a very skewed view of what happened in the past. Being able to put those two together, the daily life and the ritual life, gives me a much more holistic picture of what happened. And it opens new ideas about what were people trying to find in these places. Maybe access to a ritual area is part of the choice factor. No, the choice that went into finding a place to live. Like, many, many places I excavate look like they should be the ancient shoreline. So I dig there, I verify, yes, this is the ancient shoreline, but there's no shred of archaeological evidence anywhere in the vicinity. And I keep exploring, but no, people did not live here for some reason. They lived in other places. And as I mentioned, those other places involve the practical resources. And now we can add ritual parts of the landscape as part of their choice of where to live.
So from your perspective, because a lot of what you're describing there sounds a lot like what you find in early Lapita sites. I mean, the choice of where to live, looking for breaks in the reef, houses on wooden pilings, the red-slipped pottery with dentate impressions. So do you think that this is kind of the same source population that produces both of those streams of migration? Like that one goes one direction and then the other goes south, or they break off at some point along that southward route?
Yeah, I have been working on that topic and talking with my colleagues who know much more about Lupita than I do. I have worked at Lupita sites, mind you, but other people have devoted their entire lives and careers to studying Lupitas, like Professor Glenn Summerhays has worked at the early Lupita sites and the Bismarck Archipelago just east of New Guinea, so they're some of the oldest. And other of my colleagues have worked in Fiji and New Caledonia with Lupita sites there. I have worked in New Caledonia Lupita sites myself, so I do know what about it, and I can interact productively with my colleagues. So together, the points where we agree is that, first of all, the Mariana dating is a little bit older. So if there's a relationship between the early Mariana sites and Lupita, then it would need to be a little bit later in the sequence, like 100 or 200 years after Mariana's first settlement, when a few of those people may have traveled over into the Lupita world, like near the east coast of New Guinea, those islands, being involved in the oldest Lupita sites there, like around 1350 BC is the latest, but it could be a little older, right? It could be 1400 BC. It could even be closer to 1500 BC, like in the Marianas, but a little bit later than the Marianas dating. But the Marianas population could not be 100% responsible for what happened in the Lupita world. Like in the Marianas, those first settlers were the first people, you know, to move a long distance overseas to live somewhere. They did not bring with them domesticated animals, pigs, dogs, chickens. We also don't see evidence of rats as stowaways on those canoes. And that could be those animals simply did not survive the long journey, or maybe people planned on bringing animals with them, but they just didn't make it. But then why would they refuse to bring them later with other later cross contacts? It just never happened. Lupita sites, say in the Bismarck Archipelago, just east of New Guinea, 1350 BC, those people had those domesticated animals, the pig, the dog, the chicken. Rats were part of the environment that happened there. People were deliberately planting all kinds of new root crops like taro and yams, as well as tree crops like different varieties of banana and what they call the Tahitian chestnut and different varieties of breadfruit and new coconuts and other things, and really changing the landscape. And that happened not only in those oldest Lupita sites, but also in the later expansion, like into the remote islands of like southern Melanesia, like the farther Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, New Caledonia, Fiji, and into West Polynesia, like in Samoa and Tonga. Those movements of Lupita were founding migrations. Nobody ever lived in those islands previously, but they brought Lupita with them there. And again, looking for the same kinds of coastal places, like places right at the seashore. Their houses at that time do seem to be the same, you know, style of these wood posts raised right above the seashore and relying on shellfish in the diet, but also close to land where they could grow all those crops that I mentioned and raise the animals that they brought with them. So all that together created a much larger impact in the islands where Lupita people went to live that we did not really see so clearly in the Marianas case. And remember, this is later in time, and people may have had a different context of planning for like a major operation of movement of people to live somewhere. The sailing technology was a bit different also in the Lupita world, with larger canoes, and they're able to carry more people and more cargo and therefore create those environments where they transported their landscape with them, not just the people, and creating the landscape that they wanted based on this core idea of, yeah, we're going to look for these kinds of seashores where we know we can live productively and then create the rest to our liking. And then after a few generations, things changed, but that was the original formulation. That's like the original setting for Lupita. So in that respect, yeah, very similar to the context of people first settling in the Marianas, but at a slightly different time. And evidently, I would say, with more planning and more of an effort to transform the environment. The other thing I would notice is that in the Lapita worlds, like the older sites are not in the remote islands. They're in the what we call the near oceanic islands just east of New Guinea, where other people already had been living, right? The indigenous Melanesian or Papuan people already were there. So Lapita originated in a context of that cultural interaction. And that may be responsible for why we see such elaborate expressions in Lapita pottery, with the especially the human face motif, the labyrinth and the waves and other motifs that we see that are expressing something about cultural identity and belonging to a community that was not necessarily the case in the Marianas or in the older Philippines sites with dentate stamp pottery. So coming from the same ultimate source, the technology of making red slip pottery, the technology of dentate stamping, that originated not in the Marianas, that originated in the northern through central Philippines and then expanded. One of the places where it expanded was the Marianas very early. And honestly, that's like the nearest islands anyway. I say the nearest islands, although they're like several days' journey across the ocean from the Philippines. But it would be even farther from the Philippines. So that journey seems to have happened a bit later, and it involved close and sustained contact with the pre-existing indigenous population. So the way Lapita developed was in that context of interaction, whereas what happened in the Marianas was essentially in isolation for the first time. You know, that had not happened before. That pottery horizon first crossed from, say, Taiwan over into island Southeast Asia in the Philippines. That happened about, you know, a little more than 4,000 years ago, but people were living there as well. Those pottery making and plant, you know, harvesting and farming people, that group met with the indigenous hunter-gatherers of the Philippines, and they coexisted for hundreds of years. And so in that context, the dentate stamping and other expressions did not appear right away in the Philippines. Those people brought red slip pottery with them, but it was not that finely decorated type. That fine decoration appeared a little bit later in the context of that interaction. And one variety of it went to the Marianas. Another variety a little bit later was responsible for the founding Lapita populations, and then developed into something of its own that is like really extraordinary and elaborate that we do not see in the other places. So looking at it in that perspective calls out that the different factor is about the cultural interaction. And in fact, that's what we are told by Professor Glenn Summerhays in his studies of Lapita, is all about Lapita and interaction. You know, how did communities interact from the beginning and then moving forward through time? And his work is in that crucial place of the Bismarck Archipelago, like east of New Guinea, where Lapita people were in close contact with indigenous populations.
Yeah, so you have to define yourself if there are other people around in a way that you don't have to elsewhere.
Yeah, exactly. And then when after that development happened in the context of interaction in the Bismarck Archipelago, then like 100, 200 years later, the descendants of the original Lapita population still were making Lapita pottery, but it was a little bit different now. And those motifs and the context had been established. So those people, about 1000 BC, expanded across into the remote islands of southern Melanesia, West Polynesia, bringing Lapita with them. And their mode of interaction was among themselves, right? Or with the other Lapita communities back in their homeland, or with other remote oceanic populations.
And that makes a ton of sense. Well, Professor, on that note, we've had a real good long conversation here. I've got to cut you off. Thank you so much for your time, and thank you so much for your work. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Happy to be part of your program. And thank you again.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Tides of History ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about on Tides or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA or on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick. I write on other topics at patrickwyman.substack.com. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Jenny Lower-Beckman and Marshall Louie. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Yo, Trey.
Yeah, Kevin, what's up, man?
I was just thinking, what would have happened if Drew Brees didn't fail his physical with the Dolphins and ended up playing under Nick Saban in Miami?
There's a good shot the Finns establish a dynasty. Tom Brady and Bill Belichick probably don't become GOATs, and Tuscaloosa doesn't become the center of the college football universe.
That's a butterfly effect for real.
Hey, I'm Trey Wingo.
And I'm Kevin Frazier. We're teaming up on a new weekly sports podcast from Wondery, Alternate Routes.
As former sports center anchors and current sports obsessives, we're consumed by all the what-if questions that make being a sports fan so excruciatingly fun.
If you're like us, then you also live and die on the fallout from every drop pass
or play call.
Intercepted at the goal line by Malcolm Butler.
Sorry, Marshawn, still too soon. Each week on Alternate Routes, we'll take a flashpoint in sports, break down what actually happened, then explore every alternate scenario and the ripple effects it would have caused.
Follow Alternate Routes on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.